Listen, everybody, we all know that real estate is the most proven way to build wealth. But why isn't everyone wealthy from real estate then? It's hard to know where to start, and most of the education out there is just complete trash, and you end up investing your money on a series of courses instead of in real estate. That's not how this podcast works. We give you the blueprint to successful real estate investing and bring on guests actually willing to share their secrets. I started my real estate investing journey as a freshman in college when I bought my first duplex and have been in the trenches doing deals ever since. And today, I now own hundreds of millions of dollars of investment property. On this podcast, you will learn what you actually need to know to be a successful active or passive real estate investor. And we'll offer our takes on what's happening today so you can navigate this market and build wealth. I'm Drew Brenneman, and this is the Brenneman Blueprint.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Brenneman Blueprint. Have Steve Kundert, debt and equity advisor with CBRE, on the podcast. I think if you saw my little intro video there, he's got the number one episode of 2023. So, but besides crushing my podcast, I mean, he's done billions of dollars of lending. So happy to have you back on. And I think with this episode, want to just kind of go maybe hear what's going on just with the debt and equity markets, and then maybe go kind of like lender type by lender type, just kind of slowly hear like what each one's doing and how, you know, how the year's going.
Yeah, so. No, it's a pleasure to be back on. I'm always excited to come do this. And there's been a lot of activity this year and a lot to talk about.
Yeah. And I think if people haven't seen the other two episodes we did, maybe just do like a quick background on yourself. And
I'm a debt and equity intermediary. My title is a senior vice president with CBRE Debt and Structured Finance. And what that means is I'm a mortgage broker. So I place both debt and structured equity products on behalf of my clients, all third party capital. We don't have any proprietary funds ourselves besides being an agency lender, and work the entire spectrum of capital and the entire capital stack. So we're happy to again be here and talk through what's going on.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I think then why don't we just start? Actually, why don't we go with a different order than maybe what we did on the first one? What would you say borrowers today should be thinking about, like, first and foremost?
Well, I think the primary concern with borrowers right now are interest rates, right? So you look back on the date of our last discussion, and that was, I believe it was early March. And about a week and a half later was the banking crisis that we experienced. It was the second largest bank collapse since Lehman in 2008 with SVB, followed shortly by Signature and all the other middle market stress that we experienced. That really put the entire market into turmoil. So everything that we talked about in terms of actual interest rates and coupons during the last podcast, I think I even mentioned it in one of the comments, it became obsolete in a matter of weeks. You now fast forward to today and how that has filtered through the market and the lending environment, and it has been very significant. Because going into the last podcast, we had the discussion that there was a lot of capital allocated for commercial real estate in 2023, the same if not more than 2022. Because of the banking crisis, a lot of that liquidity, a lot of that allocation, especially from the banking community, seized up pretty tight. The middle market bank probably experienced the greatest pullback in liquidity because they were hoarding cash, not knowing ultimately what their exposure would be to everything that ultimately caused the problems with SVB and Signature. You had the larger money market banks that were already pulling back liquidity for smaller deals because of the amount of volume that they put into larger SASB deals that previously would have been CMBS last year. The local banks, ironically, have not been impacted all that much either back in 2022 or through the crisis. But because of that pullback in liquidity from the middle market banks, that created a pretty large vacuum of financing for that middle market investor. Because banks were holding back their money for either their primary clients, or if they were extending new credit, they were looking for, in some cases, unrealistic depository requirements. I had one bank that quoted me, this was for when I was marketing a loan back in April for a relatively generic power center retail deal. They were looking for 10 to 15% of the loan amount in deposits. Now that's a large amount of money to bring over to a new bank. I mean, they're almost asking for their federal depository requirements to be fulfilled by that one borrower, and that's just not realistic.
Right.
So it wasn't, whether you call it an attempt to be more aggressive in terms of trying to grab market share, or you call it an instance of quoting to not quote, whatever the reason, it was causing a big pullback in liquidity from that middle market banking.
Yeah. And I mean, there, and something else we had talked about is, you know, rates shoot up, no one's paying off the loans. Like there's very few transactions. No one's refinancing unless they're forced to. So these banks are not getting payoffs. They're worried about if there's going to be a run on the bank. Right. And everything seizes up. What would, when you say middle market size, like what size are we talking?
You're looking, generically speaking, probably a $5 to $15 million, maybe $20 million loan amount. So it's, you know, it's those banks like a, you know, put it in a Chicago vernacular, it's an Old National or a Wintrust of that, you know, that ilk.
Because those are not small banks.
No, they're not.
Where I think most of the bank lending I've done has been, the borrowing, I should say, has been with banks of that size or quite a bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And even I know you're saying the smaller banks not impacted. What's interesting is, well, won't be obvious to you and maybe not to the listener, but there's so much variation in what all these banks are doing, you know? So as I started smiling, I say the small banks aren't impacted, but then yet some are quoting 8% right now on loans, or what's your fixed rate? And it's, you know, pushing 7, where it's almost like, are we quoting to not quote, or however you put it, where they'll still, their originators are still sending out quotes, but it's not realistic,
right?
When you're competing with a Fannie and Freddie option, you know, that at the time was, you know, it's in the 5%.
Yeah. And I think that middle market bank was impacted the greatest because they are big enough to have a sophisticated enough portfolio management and treasury department, where they are diversifying their holdings into crypto, into a little bit more complicated CRE deals, into other deals that are just outside the purview of smaller local banks. If you stay to what you know, which is what the smaller local banks do, you're in less trouble. But once you get out and start to get into the products that now have national and global economic tentacles, right? Something that happens over here is going to impact you here. And that's where they started to experience the hardships and then realize that there might be a liquidity problem.
Yeah. And were many banks in crypto? I guess I knew that Signature did something with crypto, but not.
I'm using that as an example.
Oh, okay. Just the stuff that's not, yes, real estate or traditional lending. Right. Yeah. And then SVB had so much concentration with, these clients of theirs that had just so much money in the bank, like Hulu had like $400 million in the bank.
Correct.
With them. Like that's not normal. But okay. Well, yeah. So then I think let's just go kind of what each lender's doing, you know, in today's times. What does it look like for pros and cons and kind of requirements? And I mean, rates change, but kind of generically, how does it work? So, I mean, where do you want to start?
We can just go down the list of capital providers, and we'll try to tailor it a little bit to a multifamily focus. Although
we can do broader than that too, if you want. Like, mm-hmm, when we get to each.
So let's start with the agencies, because I think that's obviously the most prevalent source of capital for multifamily, and you know the agencies are still as liquid as they ever have been. The goal for allocation on the year has not changed. They're still quoting deals as aggressively as any lender in the market. There have been some changes to try to account for the turmoil in the interest rate market. For example, on the affordable program through Fannie Mae, they are now no longer offering a 35-year amortization. That's programmatically across the board. So in yesterday's world, if you have a transaction where the rent roll fulfills the affordability requirements, which is a percentage of AMI, and makes it a percentage of mission-driven deal, because at its core, the agencies that I've discussed before, their mission is to promote affordable housing.
And this is not just necessarily tax credit deals.
This, no, this is this, this is this can this does not have to be any contractual or programmatic rent control or rent limitation. This is just where is the rent roll snapshot in time relative to the larger market. So if you have a deal that is defined as affordable in yesterday's world, in addition to getting the discount in pricing, which can be every bit of 20 basis points off of conventional pricing, you also have the ability to size it to a 35-year sizing constant. So if you are looking to maximize your loan amount, it's going to be constrained by LTV, it's going to be constrained by loan to cost, it's going to be constrained by debt service coverage. Debt service coverage is relative to what your payment constant is, which gets back to your amortization. So on an affordable deal, again, in yesterday's world, you could size that to a 35-year schedule, which would make it a lower payment, higher loan amount. But now going forward, even for 100% mission-driven deals, they are eliminating that 35-year option. Hmm. So that impacts it two ways. One, that impacts it as far as your sizing constant, as well as your actual payment coupon or your payment constant. Because if you have an amortizing deal sized to a 35-year, again, not only is it going to size to a larger amount, but your annual and monthly payment will be lower. That's now 30 years across the board. So that is putting a little bit of strain on available capital for affordable deals. So you now couple that with where rates are, and you know, generically right now, Fannie Mae rates are anywhere between 5.75 and 6.625 for conventional deal, full leverage type transactions. And on the affordable side, it's anywhere between 5.60 to 5.75. Now, again, that's a snapshot of time today. Those spreads translate to somewhere around 150 to 160 for 150, 160 basis points for affordable deals, and anywhere from 175 to 200 for conventional deals. That hasn't moved all that much since both the last time we spoke, as well as going back even to our first podcast. What has changed is the index. So the payment coupon is a sum of the spread and the index. The index being the like maturity treasury for the duration of the loan. 5-year deal gets sized and priced over the 5-year treasury. 7-year deal, likewise over the 7-year treasury. 10-year deal, likewise over the 10-year treasury. You look at the 10-year treasury, which again, as of this morning, and it's important to keep an eye on that given the durability of these podcasts on the internet.
Yeah.
But as of this morning, the 10-year treasury was yielding 4.05. That is up 20 basis points from last week. That's up about 50 basis points from our last discussion back in March. So now you filter that through all the iterations of the sizing constant. What that really means is a lower loan amount on the same NOI.
Yeah, and higher payment.
Exactly.
You know, or higher interest rate.
Yes.
same payment, I guess, mm-hmm. if we're sizing a max debt cover. But yeah, it's interesting where I feel like really for the last 9 months, let's say. I mean, for the deals we've looked at, every financing strategy has just been Fannie conventional, mm-hmm. Or I guess some Freddie Mac
small as balance. Well, yes.
Well, it seemed like on the conventional side that every time we quoted something up, like Fannie was better.
As we've talked about before, that pricing pendulum kind of swings back and forth as far as who's more competitive. They're on the average about equal with each other. Snapshot in time, sometimes one is priced better than the other.
And then, so it's kind of been an interesting, I guess, 9 months where it's like normally there's so many more options to look at, and then this is like, no, the banks. I mean, most of them they're not really competitive right now compared to buying it with a Fannie loan, and then just let's say you got to renovate it out of the equity, you like raise more equity and renovate, or do it from cash flow, but mm-hmm. then focus on having the I'd rather have a 5.5% Fannie rate, fixed rate for 5 years than a bank or debt fund loan at 7 or 8 to have a construction style loan.
Yeah, and that's a great segue to the next source of capital being debt funds. And you look at the debt fund market and it's almost non-existent right now. Not because there aren't lenders in the market, not because there isn't liquidity in that sector. It's just really the cost of that capital makes it almost prohibitive to use those types of lenders. So a debt fund, which we have used before on some of your transactions, it can be a very useful tool for especially a heavy lift deal. They'll come in and potentially lend up to 80, 85% of costs. They can give you future funding. They'll have an IO constant. Some programs do have a streamlined refinance into an agency. So there's a lot of positive attributes. But because they are floating rate debt, because they are priced over the term SOFR right now, with term SOFR being north of 5% on a core multifamily deal, which is could be a spread of 3, 3.5%, your coupon's in the eights. And now you have something that's either higher leverage or requiring higher yield for whatever reason because of the risk profile. Now your pricing is 9%. You look at getting away from multifamily, you look at a debt fund on a retail deal or a land deal, you're into double digits. And that just, when you are trying to solve for an all-in return, that makes that source of capital extremely hard to navigate. On top of the interest rate protection you have to purchase, which because of the yield curve can be anywhere between 2 and 4 points of the loan amount right now. On top of the regular transaction costs, because most debt funds of size are a securitized product, they are securitizing that into a CLO, and because of the exit fee. So you typically have an entrance fee and an exit fee, entrance of 1%, and 1% loan amount, exit fee of anywhere between nothing to 25 basis points to 50 basis points of the loan amount. You add all of that together. Those are significant transaction costs that now you have to build into the overall project cost, and it makes things very hard. And you look at the overall securitized market, and the overall securitized market. This includes CLO, this includes CMBS, this includes agency MBS. It is at a 12-year low in terms of volume for the first half of the year. The first half of 2023, it was about $41 billion of total securitizations. Again, that's across all securitized platforms. That is down 70% over the same time last year. And again, a 12-year low. And I think that is because of not only the CMBS market, which we can touch on in a minute here, but now you look at, again, everything we just talked about regarding the debt fund market, that is putting a big, big strain on that source of capital.
Welcome back to another episode of the Brenneman Blueprint. Looking forward to today's episode. Have James Nelson, one of New York City's top investment sales brokers, with us today. Since 2018, he and his team, they've closed over $2.5 billion of deals. And he's been one of New York City's top brokers for a long time. So pumped to have him on and learn from him. He's also wrote a book called The Insider's Edge to Real Estate Investing. And he also has a podcast with the same title.
Happy to be here and share with your audience.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I've gotten quite a few messages or different people saying they saw that episode. So you've got a good active audience on your podcast for sure. So, but nice. Well, yeah, I think why don't you, if you want to just kind of tell us how you got going and in brokerage and just bring us current day.
Sure. So I went to Colgate class of 98, senior spring. All my friends had investment banking jobs. I had no idea what I was going to do. I thought maybe I'd go out to the West Coast to make movies or something until I realized that no one was going to pay me to do that. And I was $5,000 in credit card debt. So I went up to the Career Service Center looking for a job. And as luck would have it, there was an application due that day to go work for a real estate company in New York. I knew nothing about real estate. And believe me, today, for those of you who are listening who are maybe entering the job market, you all are a lot more prepared, certainly, than I was, certainly if you're listening to this show. But look, I got an opportunity. One of the co-founders of the company, Massey Knackel, was a Colgate grad. They gave me a shot, although they joked afterwards that there was only two people who applied for the job and I was their second choice. So, you know, we still like to laugh about that. But, you know, over time, I stuck with them for 17 years, was a partner. We sold the company to Cushman and Wakefield, which was a great thing. Had 3 great years at Cushman. And then a little over 5 years ago, received an opportunity to build out the investment sale platform here at Avis & Young. We're a global full service company with 120 offices around the world. But my group here in New York City focuses on investment sales, selling all asset classes, multifamily, retail, office, land, development. So That's my my story on the brokerage side, and we can certainly get into what I've been doing on the investing side as well as we get into the conversation.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. I think on the brokerage side, I'd be interested. You know, it's interesting that you're not specializing just in one product type. So then how do you, I'd say, what's your edge? How do you compete with the brokers that, let's say they only do office in New York, and if you guys are doing different product types, do you have specialists on your team, or how do you work that?
So as a broker, there's a couple different ways that you can approach the market because you can't do it all, right? So the company that I started with, Massey Knackel, had a territory system where we took New York City and we divided it up into 50 territories, and you had a broker in every neighborhood. And their job was to know that area and then handle the sales, which were any asset classes that were in that area, right? So you can do this from a geography standpoint. Then, as you mentioned, there's asset specialization where you can say, okay, I'm going to just do multifamily sales. I'm just going to do retail, triple net, office, development. There's also ways that you can just cover by clients, right? That's how a lot of mortgage brokers go about the business, is they really follow what their clients are doing. So I certainly grew up in the territory system. There's benefits certainly from covering a market that way if you want market share. But what I've found is that the asset classes have become so specialized, right? So if you're a multifamily investor today, it's very, you know, to understand the ins and outs, and I know you're very active, you know, throughout the country. So you can appreciate this, knowing that operating, owning multifamily could be very different, say, in Chicago as it is in Florida, right? So, you know, we have a multifamily team that we've built here that knows all the ins and outs of how to operate and succeed here in New York, investing in multifamily. And then we've got a separate retail group, office, and development. So that's how we've chosen to cover the market here.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think, Bob Knackel, he's been really active on social media. I don't know if he just started in the last 3 months or if he just finally hit all the algorithms for me on LinkedIn, at least Twitter, where every time I go on the platform, I see he's posting something. And yeah, it seemed like, I mean, that was the number one company in New York, or I mean, that was like a legendary run where he is.
Yeah. So I started my career with Massey Knackel. So I started working as Bob's associate 25 years ago, and you know, he's the master, and I learned so much from him. And even today he remains a mentor of mine. And you know, Bob always said that we were in the information business as opposed to the sales business. So the important thing, and for your audience, whether you're looking to broker, whether you're looking to invest, become an expert. I think, Drew, what makes you so successful is you've really focused in on what your expertise is. It's not, you know, multifamily even unto itself is a very broad category. So what types of assets do you like to invest in? How do you approach them? So I think that's super important. And I think social media today is just a great way to deliver content and value. And I think, you know, even, you know, this show getting out information out there, hopefully this is going to inspire a lot of people to step up their game and invest.
Yeah, definitely. What are anything that's come to mind as like the big things that you learned from Bob? I'm sure so many, but any that are worth sharing with the audience?
Well, I mean, certainly that specialization and that expertise. So when I started in the business, you know, even a year and a half, 2 years in, when it was time for me to go out on my own and take over my own territory, before I could pick up the phone, I had to study the Chelsea neighborhood in Manhattan for 3 months, get to know everything about the area, everything to know about all the sales that had taken place, retail rents. And when I went to start meeting with owners to see if they'd have interest in our selling the properties for them, when I was competing with more senior veteran brokers who had a lot more experience than I did, but I could run circles around them when it came to neighborhood expertise. And that was super helpful to me in my career. So I think specialization is really important, but also hard work. Like, this is a business where, you know, you got to put in the hours. And so we were always, you know, early on the desk, 7 a.m., getting work done out of the way. So 9 o'clock comes around, we could hit the phones.
Yeah, that's so interesting you say that. I was just in Phoenix this week, and one of the brokers I was talking to, who's the top multifamily investment sales guy, like in his size of the market, and he was talking about how he drove the market, he saw every building, just so similar to you, I'm sure, at that, you're specializing in Chelsea, you meet with that owner, and you'll know every owner on the block, and he learned every property in his sector kind of the same way. And I asked when he drove the market, and he said from 5 to 8. And I was like, and I asked, well, AM or PM? And he said, well, AM, you don't want to be missing your time where you can be calling owners. And because he would be at his desk then by 8:30 and then call till 5 or 6 or whatever time made sense to call to, but he would never interrupt that block of time. If you need to drive the market, he was doing that on the weekends or in the, you know, early morning. And I asked how many brokers in the office did that. And he said none. And so it was interesting where it was like, well, yeah, no kidding. You guys all became successful where if you're, know every owner and putting in that kind of time, finding the information, like it's no surprise how you and your team have been able to be so successful then, James. So
that's right.
That's interesting. And so then, what have you been doing then on the investment side?
Well, look, since last June, things have become very challenging for, you know, pretty much everyone, regardless of market. And, you know, first post COVID, and we were finally recovering and getting things rolling again. And then rates start going up last June. And not only has that put downward pressure on pricing, obviously more expensive to borrow money, but it's also, I think, put a lot of buyers on the sidelines. A lot of buyers have said, you know, look, I'm not going to jump in now. I'm going to wait 6 months. I'm going to wait a year. There's going to be better opportunities. There's going to be more distress. And so what's happened is sales volume has gone down dramatically. In New York City, Manhattan dollar volume dropped 70% in the first quarter compared to the trailing four. And building sales, the numbers were only off by a third. So we're still getting some deals closed, but it's just a lot more challenging because, again, buyers are very selective. And I think a lot of them are missing out on opportunities. I mean, Drew, I know you're out there looking for opportunities day in and day out. And, you know, sure, everybody wants to time the market, but there's great opportunities out there now. And one of the things I talk about in my book, which is one of the most important things to look for a great opportunity, is seller's motivation. And there are owners who need to sell regardless of what's going on in the market. And sure, it could be distress, loan coming due, have to do something, but it could also be an estate sale, partnership dispute. And I think the buyers who are out there who are being proactive and looking for opportunities are finding some great buys. I think this next year or two, you're going to see some of the greatest opportunities you've ever seen. So this is a great time to be tuning in and thinking about your next investment.
Yeah, actually, I did a podcast that said a solo one that basically said just that, where, you know, you've been on the sidelines or the brokers are too busy to call you back as a new buyer, you know, the last 2-3 years. Well, guess what? Like they got you'll have a good shot at getting your deal now. And you're supposed to buy when there's blood in the streets, and you know we're not quite at that point, but you know that's we're getting there. But yeah, then what? You know, in the markets we're in, with the transaction volumes down a similar amount. And one thing that I'm finding kind of, I don't know, interesting about the time is since there's so few deals on the market that are actually able to, you know, hit any sort of buyer expectation price wise, it's like the few distressed deals where people do need to sell or will meet the market and take a loss on their property if they bought in the last year or two, like they still get to me like aggressive pricing when we underwrite it. Like I haven't seen anything where it's like, well, they're just giving that away and you can make like a, you know, 15-20% a year on it. Cause then what have you saw in New York then? Cause I'd say they're just, velocity has slowed so much in the Texas and in Phoenix where we are that the prices haven't, they've gone down obviously, but then when you apply the new interest rate and how much money you need to put down with today's capital markets, like it's not, the returns aren't screaming like they were in 2010 when I was buying stuff, at least not yet.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting perspective because if you don't have as much deal flow and there's still a lot of capital that people want to put to work, and yeah, part of it, it's not just that it's more expensive to borrow money today, but you're getting less leverage, which is the point that you were making, especially all these regional banks who are now under pressure, right? They're not going to stick their neck out, right? So that means, yeah, you got to bring more equity to the table, and equity is still more expensive than debt in most cases. So, but as far as New York, I mean, New York's an interesting market because, and having done this now for 25 years, I mean, what you're doing nationally, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if you told me the most important metric that you look for when you invest is a cash on cash return. Like you truly are solving for cash flow. You know, New York has always been so much about you know, the hockey stick where, you know, you're getting in, you know, maybe it's a break-even proposition, but it's heavy value add and you make your money on the sell, which is really tough now because who can project where cap rates are going to be in a couple of years from now? We hope that rates flatten out and, you know, great to hear that the Fed didn't, you know, increase rates again this week, although they're still signaling that there might be another 50 bips out there before the end of the year. But still, I mean, I think that the way you make money here in New York is that value add and improving to the bottom line. And I would suggest probably anywhere in the country. I mean, for you listeners out there who are right now thinking about, hey, the only way this deal pencils is if I can sell at a, you know, 4.5 cap on the exit, I'd probably tell you, maybe take another look at the opportunity, because really the way that you add value is adding to that bottom line. And where we are having success, I mean, first of all, residential rents here, and I read an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning talking about how nationally some of the rents are starting to cool off because they increased at such a dramatic rate. And now you do have a lot more supply coming into certain markets. So that's important to study the market and understand that. But, you know, here in New York City, we have a housing crisis. We have such a shortage. A lot of our units ended up in rent regulation where, you know, those units are not freeing up. And so you have so much pressure on these remaining million or so units that exist that are fair market. And we don't even have new development happening now because we lost our tax abatement. So like in this strange way, we've seen our residential rents continue to increase at a dramatic rate. And so that's at least a positive if you're an investor, maybe not if you're a renter. But look, I see the opportunities right now. I love mixed use. I love retail. Retail is having a huge resurgence.
Today's guest is Jordan Gottlieb, multifamily broker here in Chicago with Essex Realty. Welcome.
Thanks, Drew. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and today's episode is, we're going to talk about the market with the highest rent growth in the country, Chicago. So yeah, Jordan, he had just shared an article that CoStar had put out. He put it on LinkedIn, and then I saw it. And you're from August 28th, where if you... Yeah, you want to read apart from it or should I? What do you want?
Sure. First, I have to give a small shout out to my friend Conrad, who sends this stuff to me all the time, knowing that I'm one of the biggest enthusiasts for Chicago and it being a great place to live and invest and do business. And he knew right away when he sent that to me that was going to go right up on LinkedIn and probably with a little bit of a salty caption too towards some of the haters out there. So just real quickly to summarize it, Chicago over the last three quarters, highest rent growth in the entire country. And then what CoStar did, which I got to give them credit for, also talked about the lack of incoming supply into the market. And it turns out Chicago, as a percentage of the available inventory right now, is essentially building about the least number of units in the entire country for almost any metro market out there. So just a quick headline, highest rent growth, highest demand, least amount of incoming supply. I think a lot of us took economics at some point. I forgot most of it, but I do remember high demand, low supply. You want to own something there. So I just wanted to read a little bit of excerpt just so you have it. It basically says, over the last three quarters, Chicago rents are rising 3.6% annually. I know you and I would agree just as with our finger on the market. That seems really low.
Yeah, not enough. Not enough.
10, 20%, even in some cases what we've seen. It's three times higher than the national average. Chicago's annual rent growth is five times the average of nearly the 20 other major metropolitan areas. Five times. And then just to throw a little salt in the wound in the Sun Belt, and my apologies to you because I know you do like the Sun Belt, but the markets with the lowest annual rent growth right now, Austin, Texas, Phoenix, Arizona, Atlanta, Georgia, posting respective losses of between, you know, 2.3 and 4%. I'm sure they'll be fine.
I knew you would say that. So I went back and looked before we started. In the last 5 years, Phoenix, the rents are up 33%, where Chicago is not quite at that. It's actually at half. It's at 17%. Ouch. And then over 10 years, the spread gets even wider. But anyways, yeah, there's a lot to like about Chicago. And I think the supply points are really a good one where, you know, did you say the percentages? I have it on here. Yeah, Chicago, it's 2.3% of available inventory is under construction when the national average is 5.2. But in the 20 major markets, the 20 biggest, 6.8% is the average.
In Austin, something closer to 15 to 20%.
Yeah. And then you've seen rents, at least in Austin, pull back because of that. So right before we started recording, I was saying perfect time to move there and buy on the dip. So, I mean it. So,
yeah, exactly. And I think this is kind of what I've always said, you know, about Chicago. There's a regression to the mean in a lot of these things, right? People start moving to one city largely because maybe for a variety of factors, but a lot of it has to do to upgrade your housing situation, right? Well, if everyone starts moving to the same five cities, what happens? It becomes less affordable for everybody, and then that starts to slow down. I honestly think that happened in Chicago to some extent, right? It did get quite expensive to live here, and it still is not a cheap city to live in. But as it started becoming around the same price as a lot of other cities, such as Denver, Phoenix, Scottsdale, and a lot of places in Texas, well, that starts to even out. Well, that it becomes a lot more attractive for people to live here as well. So I think things go up and down and largely end up kind of right back in the middle.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because Miami's been, like in a lot of things, the number one rent grower or price appreciation. And that's, when I see what the rents are there, I'm shocked where it's even, you know, it's more than here where you're supposed to, move to the Sun Belt because it's cheaper and more business friendly not to rent a two bed, two bath for $5,000 a month. But,
I'd actually want to use Chicago just to dispel, Miami to dispel the myth for a second. You know, we get constantly berated in these headlines about population growth or population losses in various cities, right? And it's always, you know, you get the Crane's e-blast that says this amount of people have left, this amount of people, and it's like a dire, you know, like stabs you in the chest when it happens, right? Well, that doesn't necessarily correlate to property values, right? Miami, the city and its county actually lost population in the last couple of years for the first time in going back decades. And I don't think anyone would say investing in Miami real estate over the last few years has been a bad decision for people, right?
Right.
So while I think population loss and growth can be a data point for some things, it doesn't really tell you what's going to happen in the real estate market.
Well, right. And also it doesn't tell you what's priced in. Because one thing that's maybe the most interesting of when we look at different markets is, okay, sure, just how I said Phoenix had double the rent growth as Chicago, but Phoenix, the cap rates are a lot lower. You know, where, so it's not just as simple as going, okay, rents are growing faster here, let's go there. You know, there's a lot more to it. Where in Chicago, you can buy, you know, a 6 cap, you know, today. And the lowest it felt like they ever got for the kind of stuff me and you work on was like a 5.0 cap maybe. Whereas in Phoenix, you know, people were buying 3 caps. They were, you know, be able to stabilize them to almost a 5 in like a year, but they were buying, you know, that's a huge difference in what your deal looks like where, yeah, you can't, you're going to be really limited on your debt options. If you're buying a 3 cap, you're putting a lot more equity down. It's a totally different animal. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything I'm going to say has to do with mid-market real estate, right? So I generally, in my company is doing deals between $2 million and $30 million, right? So we kind of call that the private capital market, mid-market multifamily real estate, right? Where institutions do play in this space from time to time. That's mostly in the $50, $100, and $200 million deals. Institutions are not a big player in Chicago mid-market real estate. It is a lot of private what we would call private equity or private investment, right? It's someone using their own money or it's someone doing a little friends and family type of raise. So that's what I'm discussing here. I said this for a while as people kept going to the Sun Belt and other locations. I get it. Those places were growing faster. But it was, as you said, it was priced in. We were selling 5.5 caps, maybe as low as 5, but mostly for the best stuff around 5.25, 5.5. And if you went to these places in the Sun Belt, from my understanding, mostly from you telling me actually, it was in the threes. That's a huge spread. 200 basis points, that's a huge spread. And what you weren't able to do, and I know you've covered this before, is that a 3.5 cap does not allow for fixed rate debt on a property at acquisition unless you're putting it.
Well, unless you want to do a 30% loan to value.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah.
Right. Whereas in Chicago, if you bought a 5 and a 5.25 cap, you could have put 30% down and you could have got a 10-year fixed rate debt. We sold buildings where people put a little bit more than that down and got full term interest only. And they're sitting pretty right now with increasing rents. Their expenses are relatively flat. And they're looking great right now. And I always just thought that spread was really well priced in, a 200 basis point gap. And I've always been surprised at the lack of investment from national institutions in Chicago. I think they just don't understand.
Yeah, I think, a lot of folks I've talked to, I mean, they just kind of, they don't want to deal with even learning the whole tax and
situation. Like they start just thinking, well, pensions and property taxes, and they don't even really dig in. So
I would agree. If you appointed me the head czar of Chicago real estate for a day, it would just be a dependable real estate tax structure. That's it. I don't even know that I care what the number is at the end of the day. It could be higher than what it is now. People just need to know. And that is where our challenge is when you talk to somebody about a $15 million investment here of a new building in a great location that they're really excited about, that the hardest hurdle is getting them to be comfortable with what the taxes will be, not this year, but in 2 years, 5 years. And it's challenging. It's without a doubt our biggest challenge. You can name all the other ones that they say on the news or political or an article. The biggest one is real estate tax.
No. That makes sense. And even when I moved here, the only place I had bought prior was, I guess, Madison, Wisconsin, and then in Minneapolis. In both those places, the taxes, they just chase the sale there. And you pay more if someone were to look at all the buildings, like what's your, tax percentage based on your purchase price. In both those places, people pay more. But the thing is, it's certain. So they go, in Madison, they're just going to move you to 100% of what you paid. Twin Cities, it was like in the 90s, the percentages. Yeah. So if you paid $10 million, you're going to be somewhere between $9 million and $10 million of assessed value next year. So you had a lot of certainty, but like it was like to put it in an apartment sort of vernacular, like Minneapolis, it's in the 20-something percent of effective gross income for taxes. And in Chicago, I mean, it's all over the board. It's somewhere between 8% and 22%, with most people kind of falling around the 15 to 16% window. Yeah. So that's what you see.
Depends on the building. If you have a newer building, you might be on the higher end of that curve, but certainly I've worked on a lot of vintage buildings over the last 15 years of my career. You see them as low as 5 or 6% sometimes. You see 10 and 12%. I was actually going to say the most common number we see is really between 10 and 12%. It's actually a little bit lower than you'd think. That's more for vintage stuff that hasn't sold in a while. And maybe the rents are even a little bit lower. But this is what I've heard over a period of time. Everyone thinks Texas is this low tax place, right? My understanding is if you buy a building in Dallas, they're going to chase that sale and you're going to pay what? 25% of your income?
Yeah, give or take. But also, I mean, the tax rates are essentially the same there as they are here, 2% roughly. But then they're pushing you all to your purchase price. Interesting thing with Texas is it's a non-disclosure state. So part of the reason that it's the assessors, I feel like they're aggressive, is because they don't know your purchase price actually. Because it's all private information. So yeah, if you, like any broker OM, like they're always unpriced. The taxes, they just leave them kind of as is, and you need to make your own assumption. Because they don't want to give any more ammo to the assessor, even though all the assessors, I'm sure they have CoStar and Trap, and they can just look it up or figure out what kind of loan you put on it. But so what they do though is they'll move it to what they think's market value, and they keep pushing it up. And at some point, you come in and say, "Hey, I'm assessed for $11 million. I only paid 10." And then you want to get it down to what you paid, and so that's kind of the game down there. But I think you're right. It's more about just knowing. Like it's the stability of stuff. Cause I mean, there's one example where I bought an 8-unit. This is in 2014 where the taxes were roughly 30 grand a year. And I, based on kind of what everyone would underwrite, they should be going to like 45,000 a year. So that's what I underwrote. The next year they dropped into the 20 something thousands and they've been there for the last 9 years. The main thing is like, if there was more certainty and I knew what was going to happen, like it would have been between 20 and 30,000. I could have paid more for the property, but instead I'm paying based on sort of like more of a, I don't know, I guess what it was more of a worst case scenario. We didn't even need to have in there.
I think property values would rise because there would be certainty and it'd be just easier to understand. And that's what people like when they're investing, right? People, we're in an age today where you can invest anywhere in the country, right? You're a short flight, you're a Zoom call. It's very easy to invest wherever. Even when I started in 2008, it was actually relatively uncommon for people to try to invest in places they didn't live in. It was just a lot harder, right? Technology makes it so it's not so. I'm talking about it like it's like the
thing. Yeah, yeah.
But honestly, it's reality. I knew almost nobody that invested in other places, or certainly they didn't do it in an active way where they ran the deal. They just did it passively through other people. And now with the chance to invest in a lot of places, well, if one place is impossible to figure out, your fixed expense and the other ones are easy. Even if it's more, and like I said, in Texas and a lot of times in Florida, your taxes as a percentage of your income are in fact going to be higher than here. People complain about taxes all the time, but they're actually not that high as a percentage of your income. When I started, it was almost always 15% of your income. Almost always.
You're talking about at the property? What's 15%? Personal? In the property? What are you talking about right now?
So in 2008, when I started, your property taxes would be about 15% of your something. Okay. Your state.
Yeah.
And rents were much lower. Now, I'd say they've fallen below 15% pretty substantially for a lot of buildings. And rents have doubled or even tripled since that time. So taxes here are not that bad. It's just it's a very difficult system to understand. The positive of it is if you're here doing business here and you understand all the little kinks that go along with it in Chicago, and there are a lot of them, building department, a lot of different things, right?
Board of review.
You've got a competitive advantage over a lot of people. If it's an easier market to understand, well, that might allow bigger companies, you know, playing with funny money to come in and outbid you for things. And I think you own a lot in Chicago that you might not own if it were just a little bit easier to understand.
I mean, that's, yeah, we were buying these deals where they would, go in at a 5.5 cap, raise the rents. Now it's a 6-something cap. And then we're refining out all of our equity in, with the 4-something% rate. Like that business model, that's what we were doing 2013 to 2019. That's not available if you have to go in at negative leverage on every deal because everything's growing so fast. And also that's why the Phoenix, if any headlines were it's a 3 cap, I mean, it was a 3 cap at the time of closing, but that's because rents had grown 20% since they signed a lease. So then next month you can raise the rents 20%, and pretty soon in a year you'll have a high 4 cap. So really the comparison, like in a lot of those Sunbelt places, was will you take a high 4 cap next year, or do you want a low 5 cap in Chicago right now? And next year it'll still be a low 5 cap because your rents were basically just keeping in line with expenses from like 2015 to until 2 years ago. And now, that 3% rent growth number is not enough on CoStar. But yeah, we were talking about that too, where that's because, on new leases last year, I feel like we were raising rents 5% with relative ease. And this is from like the previous high, not, of some a lot more if you're coming off a low lease or something that a 2020 low rent. And then we just did the same thing this year, if not, we're able to push it even further. Because this year last year it surprised us where everyone's renewing or these things are renting quickly. So we didn't really know what was up till it's in leasing's real seasonal. So it started in, March for your April leases. We didn't really know, hey, this is everything's really flying until maybe May. And then things start to slow down about this, at some point in August. So we just had a 2-month window where we were on fire with lease renewals and then with new lease trade outs. But then this year we knew let's assume it's going to be up again. And then we got some making up to do for last year. And so then we were up even more this year. So
I feel like the 5% number is good. I've certainly received rent rolls where rents have gone up 10 and 20% in some instances, and not from extremely low levels, from what I would have called just about market at that time. And people started really pushing the envelope if you had the right timing and the right renewal structure. So I would say Chicago has kind of taken on the same foundation as what you were describing was happening in Arizona now. When we look at deals, a lot of times, unless you had a really aggressive owner who really raised rents dramatically during the last couple leasing cycles, in theory, you have 10% upside in that rent roll without doing a thing. The only challenge in Chicago is, well, leasing season's kind of over. It's still kind of going, still kind of kicks through fall a little bit. But now you've got winter in the next spring. You've got 6 to 9 months to kind of sit on this. And is the market going to be the exact same, as it will be next year? Nobody can answer that question. However, you brought me on here to discuss the article. And I would say the fact that nobody's building anything here is going to really be an asset to the people that currently own. And not only that, that inventory that's being built, we're sitting here in the West Loop. 90% of it's being built within just a few blocks of here.
Thanks for being on, Jordan. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
If you learned something from today's show, leave a review and hit that subscribe button wherever you enjoy your podcast. Dive deeper into real estate investing on Brenneman Capital's website, Brenneman.com, where we have numerous free resources and information that can help both active and passive real estate investors. Accredited investors can get started today as a passive investor in our multifamily investment opportunities by hitting the Invest Now button on our website.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of Drew Brenneman and guests as of the date of recording and do not purport to reflect the views or opinions of Brenneman Capital LLC and its subsidiaries. Views and opinions are provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon or deemed as investment or tax advice or an offer to buy or sell securities. The speaker cannot be held responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the